Welcome to the panel on international development. This is brought to you by NAPA and also by WAPA, the Washington Association of Professional Anthropologists, which is the oldest LPO, local professional organization for anthropologists in the U.S. and maybe in the world. And we think it's probably also the most active. We have lots of services for members, like a killer job service and fantastic meetings every month with presentations preceded by a dinner. And we have just fabulous parties. So all of us are members of WAPA, and most of us are past presidents of WAPA. We're all practitioners, and we're going to talk to you about international development, which is where we practice. Adam and I are the organizers, Adam Coombs and me, and I thought up some questions for our panelists, which are briefly, to summarize, we ask three questions, and the panelists are going to be answering either two out of the three or all three. So one of the things you wanted to explore is how different is it to be an anthropologist in D.C. than elsewhere in the country? And then the second question we asked was, for skills question, we asked people to list skills that they've learned through anthropology that have been crucial to them in the field of international development, and how they present these skills, how we present these skills to non-anthropologists. And the third question was, how do we get to where we are today? So,
yes. All right, so I'll go first. So that means somebody else? Okay. We wanted to make this panel a bit distinctive. You could be an anthropologist in Chicago or Arizona or Florida, but we live here. So what was different about here? And I had to think about it a moment. One of the things is that we probably have the highest density of anthropologists per square mile of any place in the world. We have, you know, a large number of universities, but we also have a tremendous number of practitioners spread through international organizations, the World Bank, USAID, the government, private consultants, and private contractors. So one of the things that makes it unique to be here is you are surrounded, sometimes literally, by anthropologists that you didn't necessarily go to school with, that were not your professors, but you just met because we're all here together. Another thing is that that many of us work in settings where we're the only anthropologist, or we're one of maybe two other anthropologists. But because of the density of anthropologists here, people are catching on. And 30 years ago, when I said I was an anthropologist, people would giggle and say, why aren't you out digging pots? And now when I tell colleagues at meetings that I'm an anthropologist, people say, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So there has been a transformation. So there's a large non-anthropological audience that recognize us. And that presents an additional issue about Washington, D.C., which is it presents us with an audience for advocacy, because we are among people that work in government, in a lot of different agencies, and in a lot of international agencies, which is what we're focusing on here. So when we promote ideas and tag them as, oh, you know, I think we should do this based on my experience and my skills and my knowledge, and oh, by the way, I'm an anthropologist, that then gets transmitted up the system. So we have a good way to promote the value of anthropology to fairly senior level decision makers just by being here and talking and being in lots of different meetings. It's also a good way for us to interact with academia, that in many parts of the country, I think it's not quite the same, that the body of practitioners here matches the large number of professors. And whereas we wouldn't necessarily hang out at a university once we've left it, but we interact with them through WAPA and through other meetings and things. So it's an opportunity for us who work in international development or in other fields to be aware of what the academic community is saying about the same thing. So we can talk to professors that are doing international development while we go to our office and do the same thing, and we get to interact with them. And the other thing that's different here in anthropology in being in Washington is just the sheer magnitude of international work. I mean, that's the basis of this panel is international work. That's why I moved here. That's why I came to school here. And every time I've come back to the United States from being overseas, that's why I re-moved here to be at the heart of international work in the United States. And I'm just going to skip to what Lori said was the third question, which was, where am I now? So in the course of being in Washington, in and out of Washington, right now I work for an international non-governmental organization. We do humanitarian assistance and development and education and disaster relief and refugees and all of that. So I'm the senior vice president. So that's another opportunity to say, I have a senior management position. I can actually impose my views on people, and yet I'm an anthropologist. And people start to see that didn't really make sense, but now they're starting to understand that anthropologists do have ideas in management, and that we have the authority to implement those. And just briefly, I'm not sure how much time I have, that the skills that are handy here as an anthropologist working in development, working in Washington. And one of them is, you know, a classic anthropological skill, which is observational skills, participant observation. That, you know, when you work in the World Bank as opposed to the U.S. Agency for International Development as opposed to a contracting agency, they all have their corporate cultures. And we as anthropologists won't barge in. At least my experience and with my colleagues is you have the skills to sit back and understand the jargon and understand the behavior and understand most of all the power dynamics inside of your office and the office that's inside of your office and the office that controls your office. So those observation and participant observation skills are really useful because then you adapt to that culture and you can survive by you know, going native and actually being an effective aid officer or NGO officer. Understanding different worldviews. It's a real mixture here in Washington. And one of the things that we have also is there are a lot of international workers that work in Washington. And they have come to the United States to do international development, and they've come to Washington. So we have like a little mini United Nations. In my office alone, I think only 20% of the people are American. And so understanding different people's perspectives, and anthropologists are very good at that. So if you've come from the Philippines and you've jumped into an American office setting, it's really different than if you've come from Ghana or if you've come from Sudan. And if there are issues in the office or if people are having trouble adjusting or if you want everybody to operate effectively on the same team, we're pretty good at that, at diagnosing or identifying, well, there are four different cultures operating on the same task team. How can we mediate between, you know, cultural sense of humor, cultural sense of power, cultural sense of ethics, of work ethics. So we're really good at that, and that happens a lot in Washington. Linguistic adaptability and sensitivity, it's the same as the cultural perspective, is if you say something either, you know, in an NGO, it might not work to say that same thing in a government setting. Or it might not work to say that same thing around a bunch of Muslim staff, or Buddhist staff, or Jewish staff. So we, you know, as an anthropologist, it seems like second nature to step back and say, I was going to say that, but how will that be perceived? I might change that sentence a bit, or I might introduce people to how we speak, so that they won't be offended, so that what we're saying or what they're saying is not taken the wrong way. And the last thing I had for a skill is just information triangulation. That Washington is a Washington is a center of data overload. And for any given topic that we work on, there is 10,000% too much information. And how do you extract that to make it useful? And there's policy, and there's theory, and there's practice, and there are lessons learned, and there are good examples and bad examples, and all of this. And I think that anthropology gives us some basis in some of our training in how to extract what's useful, and how to take qualitative and quantitative and, let's say, questionable data and totally reliable data and synthesize that into something that we can use in the office or use when we jump out of the helicopter in Haiti. So I think that working through the data and the information to come up with something that's actionable is an anthropological skill that you don't necessarily learn entirely in graduate school, but you fine-tune that, but it gets a start in your training.
Adam, you're talking.
I'm Mary Clark. I'm going to start with the last question. Where am I now? I'm a senior consultant at the World Bank. I have been doing this nearly 10 years. I aimed to do it much earlier, but it was a matter of weaving through various other opportunities to get there. One of Lori's questions was, how did I choose Washington? Washington actually chose me. I was looking for opportunities as I was defending my dissertation. I had been bid on one project to work in the Philippines where it wasn't terribly peaceful at that time, and that failed, and they passed on my CV to someone in the Office of the Women in Development at USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development. I applied for the job, which was actually instructional media. The director saw my PhD and said, oh, I have another opening. So I became a labor advisor. She felt if I had a PhD, I could handle this. I thought, okay. And I moved on, learning very rapidly, as Adam suggested, this moving into USAID speak, learning about all the different development agencies very fast, and learning to talk with economists using the skills that Adam was talking about. One quick scenario, I was working on the Economist Conference as one of two women and no anthropologists. And the economists weren't quite up to date, and they brought in this really rising star from Chicago. So they asked me, what is this guy's paper about? It was like all equations. And so I called up my advisor, Robert Netting, and said, help, what am I going to do? He said, you're an anthropologist. This man can talk, call him up, talk to him, ask him what his paper's about, and advise him that these people aren't up to date, which I did, and the economists were very much impressed that I could deal with this guy that they didn't completely understand. And indeed, he did a paper that wasn't all equations, so that the outdated economists at USAID could understand that. I was able to move on to other opportunities, doing consulting for various firms, worked some consulting for the Asian Development Bank. I worked with an NGO, but I was doing fundraising, which I discovered was not my most favorite type of activity, although a very useful skill to have. And I also did some project management, which I found rewarding, working with the staff, but dealing with all those budgets, I decided, no, this is not what I want to do. So I tried to move myself in the direction of going back to being a technical expert. The way that I got my entree into the World Bank started when I was a graduate student. I was working on my various courses, and the professor I was working with was contacted by a buddy of his from graduate school who was looking for someone at the World to do a background study. So I did this. I stayed in touch with this person, and he is the person who put me in touch with the whole line of work that I've been doing for the last 10 years, which is working on gender and infrastructure, starting with gender and transport, moving to gender and engineering, working with engineers, moving on to energy and water. So I'm now a totally independent consultant working directly only with World Bank people, but I'm working with about five different task team leaders on different kinds of projects. I would like to talk a little bit about what's left of the skill set that Adam hasn't already covered, which he did a very thorough job of. One of the things that he alluded to that I found extremely useful throughout is combining quantitative and qualitative analysis. Qualitative analysis is now recognized as a valuable way of assessing the quantitative data and even designing quantitative research. That is something that is really saleable for an anthropologist bringing in those kinds of skills. And the holistic perspective systems approach is really, how am I doing time?
Fine.
Okay. Systems approach is really very helpful to connect with other disciplines and help other disciplines, for example, working with agriculture and making them aware of the health connections in an agriculture project, or a water project and making them aware of the health connections and the infrastructure connections, where their disciplinary training is to be more kind of linear and focused on their particular discipline. So that's been extremely helpful. And it's also has been, for me, a very helpful framework to rapidly learn about disciplines that I suddenly find myself deeply involved in. I did not expect I would be working in transport. I had no training in engineering or road construction, but I've learned a great deal, and my anthropological background framework that I've worked with, that sort of guided me, has helped immensely in doing that. And as Adam suggested, learning about other disciplinary cultures who really have the skill set to do that, and working someplace like the World Bank or USAID, it's absolutely vital to get into the language that they speak, to be taken seriously, and also to understand what on earth they're talking about when you're in a meeting and they're talking in their particular speak. Another thing which isn't necessarily coming out of your training, but hopefully is flexibility. Flexibility to deal with all these diverse disciplines and cultures, and flexibility to take a different track than you thought was going to be the path you're going to take when an opportunity opens up that can really be getting you to where you wanted to go by a more indirect route. I've been very opportunistic, and it's been very rewarding for me, and I found myself doing tasks that I didn't anticipate doing or didn't think I could do, but with the kind of background that we have as anthropologists, it's really quite amazing what we can achieve. Another skill that is really essential is good writing and communication skills. Particularly in a context like the World Bank, a lot of people do not have English as their first language, and for some of them it's very difficult to write well. So I find myself doing a lot of editing and revision when I'm working on a team with people, because they're not communicating the important messages in an evaluation, in a study. And so the writing skills are very much valued, as are the interpersonal communication skills, the training, speaking skills, all those kinds of skills, which hopefully you have gotten in the context of your training and education are very, very important. I think my time is nearly done.
Yes,
so
you have
1 minute. So what I'd like to do is suggest that our anthropological framework really gives us the toolkit to put a human face in any direction we want to pursue in international development. And if you want more details about this circuitous career path of mine, there is a Napa Journal article in the Women at the Frontier edition, and there, I also have a couple of chapters in the Handbook on Applied Anthropology, Applied Practicing Anthropology,
yes,
which came out fairly recently, so
last
you can look there for more details. That was
right.
John Stern.
Can you join me?
Yes.
Right, my name's John Mason, and I've recently come off of a retainer for a very small firm in Vermont that does international work. They were gobbled up by a very big firm in San Diego, California, and just watching the cultural change of that integration was a phenomenon unto itself. I'm going to look at things a little more from a geographic perspective, thinking about Washington as a a geographic place on the map and also a very important political place on the map. My work has been mostly for about the past 15 years in monitoring and evaluation, which you may wonder, well, how does measurement get reflected in cross-cultural, comparative cultural paradigms? Well, it does. And if you're just looking at numbers, you're kind of missing the point. But if you look for causation, how people participate in projects, the socio-cultural, political parameters are most critical here, as well as in evaluation. My fieldwork was in a Libyan Saharan desert oasis, and I didn't come to Washington directly from there. I taught university in Benghazi, Libya, in upstate New York, and in Cairo, Egypt, and then I decided to leave academia, transitioned through a UN United Nations position into the more applied world. Working at the United Nations itself was a cross-cultural experience, same kind of thing that Mary alluded to in the World Bank. You really have to learn how people operate from their different geopolitical and cultural positions. Now, we moved here, my wife and I moved here over 30 years ago. I'm a Marylander now, I'm a New Yorker by origin, mainly working with NGOs and contract firms, which some of which placed me in USAID for certain contracts. We moved here in a pre-internet period of time, and it's made a huge difference because had I had the choice, I probably would have liked to have remained in Boston where I did my graduate work. But at that point in time, you really had to have FaceTime in Washington where all these powerful people congregate, and they're the ones who give the jobs. Living, in response to the question of living in D.C., it's a little bit like living in a bubble. If you read the newspapers closely each day and get involved mentally with the political scene here, it can be somewhat enervating depending on your political perspective. There are lots of egos in this town that one has to deal with, not just in the political arena, but also in the workaday arena. Networking in this city is critical for getting anywhere fast. Either you have to know someone before you come, or come and find someone who will help you cultivate your position here and maybe mentor you into a position. I didn't fall directly into a full-time slot. I did a consulting job for an NGO, and then after looking at my work and determining that I could fit in personality-wise into the organization, I was hired. So that's one would not expect to just land a job necessarily. It depends, again, on the proverbial network. On the second question about moving to D.C., as I said, it was from Libya, but it was from my UN position, and I basically needed to be in a place where the most jobs were non-academic jobs, and so that obviously led us here. One of the constraints of working as a contractor is that a lot of the work is tied to a project cycle, which may be 2 to 3 years, or maybe 3 to 5 years, rarely more than 5 years, so sometimes you find yourself at the end of a five-year contract and, oh dear, I've got to refurbish my network and get moving again and searching for the next job. There are lots of benefits. I'll mention some of them later. One of the big draws for me was the existence of WAPA, the Washington Association of Professional Anthropologists. And we, most of us are practicing, but we're all inclusive of academics as well. On skills that I can say that derived from my work as an anthropologist in this setting, but mainly being sent out to different world regions, is the acquisition of languages. The importance of learning a foreign language, or two, or some people speak three or four. I work somewhat in French, somewhat probably less capable than Stanley here, and in Arabic. And I found that very useful, particularly for doing work out in the field where if you have the luck of getting a job where you're actually surveying people in a village. Either you've got to have very good translators or yourself have adequate language skills. A second skill is in serving clients, figuring out what clients really want, not just on what the words in the contract say, is very critical. And getting along with them, kind of greasing the skids, it's all very important because remember, this is a political town. You're talking with someone from the Agency for International Development, although they're a civil servant or a foreign service person, they're wrapped up in the political bureaucracy where they work. And you have to learn that speak, as Mary was saying. Being able to design a project, administer a project, write a scope of work, these are all things which have come out of working in this town. Interestingly, and at first not a very happy situation for me, I found that in many cases I was called upon to do pretty heavy statistical work. Ethnography was always my love. Statistics were, I had graduate school statistics, I knew how to talk the talk, but to walk the walk, you got to do a little more than just say the right words. So I learned quite a bit about advanced statistical applications, and in this results-oriented world in which we live, looking for objectives and measuring them as results, you really have to understand statistics. So that was an important lesson. And then fifth, like this is, I guess, endemic to any work you do, but being able to manage your computer is very critical in terms of learning how to do diagrams and statistical charts. I found to be very useful because there are no secretaries anymore, or it seemed to me there weren't. So you really had to learn these skills yourself. Mentoring is another thing I've learned from both the work situation and through WAPA, where I've done mentoring over the years. Lastly, I've learned to enjoy Washington, D.C. When we came here 32, 33 years ago, it was sort of a sleepy little town, some would say a southern town. But now it's a good place to raise kids, good place to send them to school, lots of musical and art events, some free museums, which is a very nice thing, and then the universities with the benefits that they offer for professional exchange. And then finally, improved restaurants, particularly ethnic restaurants. And I'm going to use that as a way of segueing into some food for thought questions for you. Two of them, and I'll read them. Given a liberal, this is not true, I'm sorry. Given a liberal political bent of anthropologists in general, what is involved in keeping a neutral perspective with clients in this politically gridlocked town? And secondly, what are the pros and cons of a government job versus a private sector job? I've not given you the parameters of the public sector, but you may want to ask about that. So thank you.
So, Stan.
Sure. My name is Stan Yoder. I just finished recently doing a series of studies for a private company. When I was looking at my points that I want to make, my five paragraphs written out yesterday, I realized that if you're an experienced ethnographer, it's all everything that I say is just common sense. So excuse me for repeating things that a lot of you already know. But for the past 30 years, I've been working on designing and directing health health research in different countries in Africa, kind of all over the continent. But I was first trained as a social anthropologist at UCLA, and at a time when I did my regular 2 years field work in southern Congo, which when it was called Zaire, down in Chokwe villages down along the Angolan border. And I wrote a dissertation on Chokwe knowledge of illness and medicine, and was an apprentice to Chokwe healers over a period of time. And I thought I would probably get a teaching position in a university somewhere to continue my ethnomedical studies. But that never happened, and so I became a specialist in the study of health and illness in different countries in Africa. It kind of fit because I had done a master's degree in African studies before and an MPH while I was writing my dissertation. So that did come together. So I spent quite a few years at the University of Pennsylvania doing research on health communication, evaluation of health communication projects, and then a long stint as a consultant, mostly in West African countries, in program evaluation. The last 15 years working at MACRA International, the group that does the national demographic and health surveys around the world. So I want to talk about five skills or strategies that I found useful over the years in both designing and directing research. The first one is I've always paid very close attention to language, to the way individuals describe their experiences or their own lives in their own terms. The fact that I had learned to speak a couple of languages and then did my research in the Chokwe language helped me to take much more seriously local terminology. In fact, it reduces the temptation that people often have that all good and relevant ideas can best be expressed in English. It's true, and you hear that. I also developed a way to have women in small groups talk about their own symptoms, what they know about symptoms of childhood illness and how they diagnose illness and seek treatment in three of the different languages in Mauritania, and I used that kind of technique to study ethnomedical knowledge in a number of other countries over time. The skill involved is just being able to get people to talk about their own experience without giving them any information. It's all in the kind of questions that you ask. Second, I came to recognize the importance of using local experience as a frame for designing research that seeks to understand people's actions or behavior. For example, if you're trying to study modern family planning methods in a country like Kenya or Mali, you shouldn't focus on knowledge of modern family planning methods. Rather, you should focus on, you have the image of the woman in a sexual relationship who does not want to get pregnant, and try to understand from her own perspective whatever she does. And if modern family planning methods are relevant to her, that will come out in and of itself. Third, in the design of any kind of data collection instrument, the questions in a questionnaire or a conversation guide must be formulated in a way that makes sense to respondents. That is, the terms and concepts invoked must be completely familiar to them. A puzzled look after a question is asked means you have failed to do your job properly. Many terms and concepts used by outside researchers are culturally specific. This is only common sense, but you'd be surprised how often people do not follow that. The skill involved is just finding ways to acquiring enough knowledge about local knowledge and practices to be able to ask questions that make sense to the people you're working with. It is only common sense, but I work with demographers, I work with statisticians, I work with psychologists, public health people. They somehow do not see the importance of principles of that kind. Fourth, in training researchers, you work with what your respondents give you. If you're training researchers to conduct interviews, for example, you first discover what ideas and experiences they have in relationship to the methods and topics to be addressed. Once that is established, you can then build on that to train them in skills that expands their own abilities. You can help them understand the logic of the study you've designed. Once they understand the logic of the study, they'll be much better prepared to guide the conversations or observations that they do in the field. The training process should really be a two-way street. And last, in designing new research, I've learned the importance of beginning with specific research questions and building out from there. That is, a researcher decides on a general question to explore for a specific study, or maybe a researcher is given a topic or a question by a client. That happens often. You and the researcher can then summarize everything you know about the issues in question, including the assumptions you're making. Once that is complete, it's at that point that you decide what kind of data collection method you want to develop and your analysis plan, and not before. So at the end, then, when you look at what you've learned, when you're after you have your analysis and you're writing up a report, then you compare where you are at the end with what you were from the beginning, what you had from the beginning, and then you get a sense of what you've actually learned in the process of your study. And I had another few words, but I can't find them. Anyway, so specifically, I became an applied anthropologist because the opportunities were there, and I realized that I've been able to use my ethnographic skills in lots of different ways, and it's been a really rich and rewarding experience. So, you know, it's a little bit of, was a little bit of surprise, but no regrets.
Okay, so Chair.
Okay. As the last person on the
almost last because Lori's going to speak.
I'm sorry?
Lori is going to speak afterward, after you.
Oh.
So you're not the last.
There we go. Okay.
You're not
I was going to say, well, I was tempted just to say what they said. But I was thinking about what my preparation for this little session, and I remembered my first class in anthropology. It was a political anthropology class taught by Eric Wolf. And somewhere in the course of that class, he said, actually, anthropologists are born and not made. And I think I have to go along with that. I retired as a Foreign Service officer with the U.S. Agency for International Development. I spent 28 years with USAID. I served in Pakistan and Bangladesh and Nepal and Peru as long-term overseas postings. Did two tours in the Washington, D.C. headquarters, and did a very large number of short-term TDY assignments in places ranging from Poland to Madagascar to Jamaica and so on. I'm now a consultant, off and on, and the last thing I did note was I was a Water User Association advisor for a very large Asian Development Bank funded project in Western Afghanistan, and primarily my job there was to work with organizations that had an over 500-year history of managing irrigation water in a very difficult climate in such a way that they would be able to continue doing this after major projects sponsored by the central government came into place. I had to leave before I finished that, and I don't know how it's going to work out, but that is also the norm for consulting jobs. My viewpoint on anthropology, applied anthropology, and also on Washington, D.C. is maybe a little bit different because I was hired off the street in Pakistan by USAID. I was doing a research project, and they said they needed to somebody who could tell them why these well-designed projects weren't working. My network, luckily, was functioning. I came across a person in Islamabad as I first arrived there who said AID is looking for such a person. I went over it, and they said, when can you start? And after the usual tedious government processing and so forth, a year later, I did start. And their projects were not well designed, and they weren't working, and they probably shouldn't have worked. And they really didn't appreciate somebody saying so, because so I had to learn how to become much more diplomatic than is my norm to go the second step, not only saying your projects stink, but also here's what you can do to make them turn out well. So for 28 years or so, I did that, but my viewpoint became much more that of a manager than of a researcher. My viewpoint became much more that of the decisions and how information can contribute to decisions which I or other people have to make regarding the use of resources, versus someone who comes as a consultant, as an academic or otherwise, comes in, is given the scope of work, does a study, writes a report, and goes home. I also found in dealing with anthropologists as a manager, they're very difficult, relatively speaking, because they want to do what they want to do and not what the scope of work says they should do. And so at least three or four times in my career, I had to tidy up after someone who didn't do what we needed done when we needed done. My interest has always been in vertical linkages in civilizations and complex societies between the high levels, the state level, the national level, and above, on the way down to a series of intermediary organizations and down to the community and household level. And specifically, I was interested in how political patronage works, how social change is mediated by political middlemen at various levels. And this translated very well. I did that as my dissertation in India. And this translated very nicely into looking at how development, international development, systems function, because development is delivery from the donor or the fund, or the original source, down to the end user, whether it's money, commodities, training, technical assistance, or just information. The idea is that it trickles down, that's not the term, it flows down, and the metaphor that I learned early on, thank goodness I was working on an irrigation management team with an economist and ag engineers, irrigation engineers, and they pointed out that what is the purpose of this kind of delivery system? In the case of irrigation, if the water does not get to the root zone of the plant on time with the right amount and the right quality, the entire system is useless up to the headworks. And this is a very different perspective I found from a lot of donors and donor organizations whose work looks primarily at the headworks and the focus of projects. And they stand on the headworks and they assume everything is going to work out down below. And in the meantime, as you know, there are problems with silting and delays and things. There are problems with rat holes where various functionaries at various levels can siphon off the essential resource. So that became my specialty, stopping up rat holes and dealing with siltation in the institutional side of development projects and delivery systems. And so my focus is on delivery systems. My focus is from upward to downward, but insisting on feedback elicited from the end user as to what kind of a plant am I and when do I need the water and how should it be delivered to me. And then designing programs or monitoring programs or evaluating programs that look at these kinds of issues. So that's what I've been doing. Talking about skills, most of them were mentioned, language skills. I was lucky. I got training early on in how to learn languages and learned Spanish and Urdu, some other things. That turned out to be very, very useful. Writing, still pain. But the kind of skills I wanted to mention here, something I picked up as part of my anthropological training that has served me in my professional career. One was the ability to identify and do analyses of what I like to call sociocultural systems. And these are defined in particular ways, but they can be of any degree of scale. They're not just communities or business firms or villages or something like that, but the ability to define these rather rapidly, to determine the essential qualities and functions of time, space, environmental surroundings, resource flows, decision processes, recruitment, training, membership, and so forth, and the appropriate rituals and symbols that identify and define these systems. And then being able to do this in terms of a chain of delivery from the top, from the headworks down to the tail, through the series of intermediary associations, from the donor, through the government, to NGOs, down to various kinds of local communities or other organizations, and being able to either design these kinds of things or get them done or do them myself under constraints of time and funding and other resources is something that I think I owe a lot to my original social anthropological training. Something else I picked up along the way, which is what I call inquiry by extension, because in some cases, for various reasons, I or similar kinds of researchers aren't able to access the end users that we are concerned with. For example, in Somalia, a high conflict area, couldn't go there, and it was a very touchy situation. So one of the things I learned how to do was to train local people as sort of probes into the local situation, to train them in such a way that they could then report on an intermittent basis about questions of interest. It's something I picked up. It turns out that the Punjab Board of Economic Inquiry in the old pre-El Colonial India used this regularly, but it does work, and I found it as a skill that, given the kinds of places we tend to work in development these days, it may be more important. And finally, the use of the understanding of and the use of rituals and symbols as part of team management and team participation, especially with multicultural teams, where you think of things that can be put up to bind them together and make for comfortable working situations. And I gather that that's the end of me.
Spiritually speaking,
thank you.
What they said. I won't repeat what people have said, just to maybe to highlight a little bit of what some people have said, and maybe to summarize a little bit. I think it almost everyone has said that their dissertation topics were really important, and that language was very important, and that networking is very important. And all of those things are very important, things that we learned as anthropologists. As for being in Washington, D.C., Adam said that networking is super important, and it is. It's how we get jobs most often. And, for example, there are some government agencies which will remain nameless where all the jobs are wired, essentially. In other words, before they're advertised publicly, they already know who's going to get that job. And so the only way to get that job is to have someone in the organization, in the agency, get the job for you. And that's where other anthropologists come in handy.
Yes, or why?
Although, actually, I haven't seen that done by other anthropologists. And then, of course, there's WAPA. And WAPA is the place for networking par excellence for anthropologists in the nation's capital, especially in international development, for the reasons that people have said. In fact, I found my first job at a graduate school through WAPA. When I was finishing my dissertation, my very first anthropology professor, as an undergraduate, advised me to borrow money. I'd been teaching at a school at the University of Upstate New York, to borrow money and to come to Washington, D.C. and go to a WAPA meeting. So I did, and at that meeting, the president announced that there would be all the WAPA members would be going to a bar after the meeting, and that in fact, that's where a lot of networking went on and where job information was exchanged. So I did, and I sat next to a Peruvian anthropologist who told me that the place where he worked, Foreign Area Studies, which is where a lot of anthropologists of a certain age started out in Washington, at American University, was looking for a Middle East specialist, a new PhD. So the next day I called up, I got the interview, and I got the job. And about 2 weeks later, I was in Washington, D.C., and I have been a stalwart member of WAPA ever since. So it was, by the way, a truly seedy bar. So they kind of had to you know, when I think about the skills, I know we said skills, but I think it was coursework that I took that has been really helpful. For example, I took an anthropology course in graduate school, anthropology, mind you, in graduate school, on program evaluation. It was taught by a practitioner. And that course has served me very well throughout my career. When I started looking for a job in international development, I already knew something about program evaluation, which was extremely rare for any anthropologist at that time. And I took one of my specialties in graduate school is population and family planning, reproductive health. And at that time, I took several graduate anthropology courses on family planning, population, and reproductive health. They were all taught either by a practitioner or by a former practitioner who come then to academics. And that was at the anthropology department in UNC Chapel Hill. And the courses gave me a practical as well as the ethnographic and theoretical background in family planning and reproductive health that's far superior to the NPHs and even the doctors of public health who are working in those fields. I use that grounding every single day in my career. Now, a real skill from anthropology is the ability to notice and focus on myriad details and to make sense out of them accurately, whatever that means. And to abstract the whole from the swamp of details, in other words, ethnographic analysis. And that's been suggested by several of the members. So in graduate school, as I say, I focused on population and human reproduction, sexuality and gender, and on what then we call symbolic anthropology. Since, again, this is a dissertation factor, since I did my dissertation field work on family planning in a peri-urban neighborhood in metropolitan Cairo, Egypt, I had to learn Arabic. I got my first full-time position in international health at a time when the United States was giving more money to Egypt in foreign aid than any country other than Israel. But few Americans, other than John Mason, spoke Arabic. So here I was, someone who knew about family planning in Egypt and spoke Arabic. So I was able to find a job in health communication, health promotion, which was then called Information, Education, and Communication, at an NGO that had just gotten a large subcontract to work on family planning in Egypt. I consulted between the, not my next full-time job, but I guess it's at the same office Mary worked at, and John worked at, and he worked at AID, the Office of Women in Development. Where I was a nine PhD anthropologists, although no one on the panel was working there at that time. But I found the job I have now that I've had for 15 years because I was hired to do something in water sanitation and hygiene, which I hadn't worked on before. And then after a year, I said, I can't stand working with these engineers anymore. Get me out of it. I was a project manager. Get me out of here. So they invited me to the office to be a full-time staff member other than the project because they had a big subcontract on a maternal child health project in Egypt. So again, Arabic in my dissertation helped. And so the subcontract that brought me originally into international health full-time with Egypt not only got me a job, it got me my husband, who was my counterpart at the Egyptian Ministry. Finally, I worked for.
Give and get.
Yeah, right.
Happens all the time.
So I've worked for 30 years in health promotion, health communication. information. And this field, as people here can attest, has little or no understanding of history or how economics, politics, or culture serve to separate or divide people. And of course, in the United States in general, and certainly it's reflected in international health, workers' social class is not a concept. But then neither a meaning, identity, or culture. I use an anthropologist's understanding of these constructs, as well as an applied theory of culture, culture models, to design, I hope, as projects based on anthropological social science research and anthropological theory that tend to be more successful than those designed by simplistic, dumbed-down social psychology theory. So, so that is what we have to say. And now, you have asked questions about of the audience, I assume, our participants here at this lesson. And you can ask questions of us, or if any of the rest of you have any questions to ask participants.
I have one more question to throw into the mix so that we have a number of questions floating around chaotically. None of us here are kids anymore, sorry to say. And somebody, one of us said that you came here pre-internet. And so I'm curious, because I do most of my management now in an approach called remote management, which is mostly, I live on Skype, which I hate, but I'm wondering whether any of us could have done what we do, or another generation could do this, now that we have the internet and Skype and WhatsApp and Facebook and everything else. Have we progressed past needing to live in Washington to do this?
I think once you build your reputation, you can move to, you know, your cottage in Colorado, something like that. If I could just add also, the fact that we all happen to be PhDs may seem kind of daunting to, not necessarily everyone, but to some of you. I've found a lot of the work that we have done over the years doesn't require a PhD.
Not at all.
And so just to give a level of comfort to those of you who may not be thinking about a PhD, because it's quite an endeavor, but thinking about the kinds of questions you might have regarding, you know, how much, what level of expertise do you really need to land a gig in Washington, and, you know, how important is a PhD versus an MA?
Different aspects, though, in terms of doing the actual work. However, a lot of the organizations in Washington calculate salaries and rank according to educational credentials. I could have a PhD in farm management. As far as they're concerned, it doesn't make no difference. As long as I have the PhD, I get that kind of salary.
But that's not true in the NGO sector at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, sometimes it helps, sometimes it doesn't. In my sector, it doesn't help at all.
I have a question, it's not quite a specific one, but I'm looking into also getting into consultancy and coming fresh from a PhD. And the question is, how much expertise is expertise? I mean, on the one hand, it's, as an anthropologist, you have expertise in participative observation more generally and broadly, in this idea of understanding processes. But how, like, when you're trying to promote yourself as a consultant, what is your expertise precise, as you were saying, what your research was on in that specific region of the world? Or how far can you zoom out and just be more of a general expert? I mean, I'm just now starting to look for jobs, and I wonder, how do you promote yourself as an expert?
It's a good question. It's hard to break in.
It is,
because they want someone who's trained as a specialist. And so as anthropologists, we've all specialized. Some of us have multiple specialties.
But that is a good way to think about it. You have the two poles. You have the geographic interest and experience, and maybe even a language. and then you would have specific research skills that have to do with program evaluation or survey planning and directing surveys and so on. And I think it's useful to think of those as two separate poles. And for some jobs, one is a little more important than the other. Mm-hmm. But I think you do need both.
Yeah, and then for doing the resume, you say, not just what my skill is, but what have I done with it, and what was the result of that? Did I improve something or make something better or make more profit or whatever? But the idea is to convince someone that by hiring you, they're going to have value added.
Mm. And just building on what Cher is saying, they're not just looking at where you studied and what you've learned, but what experience you have in applying that in international settings. And that's a major obstacle for the initial entry, because they want you to have the experience, but you have to get the experience, and so you've got to find angles to get that, to build up your repertoire of actually applying your knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And that's where networking comes in, too. You have to get someone
right.
who'll be on your side and give you that first opening, and then you can cite something. And I would say, I echo what John is saying, it's really important. The most important thing is after you establish your reputation, you can learn anywhere. But before that, you've got to live here.
Also, internships are part of this. Some of them are not paid, and I find it somewhat exploitative, but that is one route to getting hands-on experience.
Yes. You're building a track record. And then when somebody like me is looking for someone to do a job, I always say, I'd be happy to give you your second or third job.
That's encouraging.
Can I get back to something that Laurie said about networkers? This has come up a number of times. So here you are, you professionally have your resume and skill set in hand, and you're coming to the door, and you want in the door. You've got two opportunities or two chances. One is to have somebody on the inside you pass your resume to, as we talked about networking, and they are going to sell you basically on the inside. Or you're here trying to get in through however you can. I think I know in my head, but what do you think in terms of percentages of people who have that back channel networking, what percentage does that represent versus the people who successfully can come to the door not knowing anybody but just based on their own skills get inside?
You don't go to the door. You go to a reception, you go to a conference, you go to someplace where you can meet somebody in a more informal setting,
right.
make a connection,
right.
a face-to-face
right.
connection, impress them that you really have something to offer and you have skills that can apply.
Right.
So then you get the meeting to go through the door.
Right.
That's the initial, that's the networking, but not just going to the door.
Right, that's the point, is that you have to, there's all this legwork, so, it can be a year before that happens. But
and you have to do the research
inevitably,
approach that person, so you know what their priorities are.
But that's the point about being in Washington, and that's, not to get obsessive about it, but you can't do that over Skype, but it takes a while. And there are all of these things. There are internships. There are conferences. There are meeting people for the famous informational interview, or meet over coffee. But we all know what that's code, and we all know what it means. And I'm always able to do some of that, and others are as well. But you have to be there face to face, and that's the value of it. And after that, but then it's not just parachuting in for a week, and there has to be a bit of durability involved in being able to stay for a couple months, because it's a process. And after that, sure, then you go off to South Sudan or the Philippines or something, but you need to kind of be physically here, and you're not going to cold call somebody on a Skype video.
Homework is critical for going to an organization, finding out as much as you can in advance about the cultural norms, everything from dress to how they think and speak, and particularly what they focus on. And the internet, of course, offers all kinds of assistance in this domain. But we had to do this by hoofing it before the internet came around.
It's field work.
It's field work.
Yeah. And just as serious as doing.
Like all field work, it requires, you know, managing your entree, establishing your rapport, and then once they hire you, you still have to define an acceptable status to both you and people you're with. That's field work. That's ethnography, whether you're 101 or something.
I have another comment to that specialist versus generalist issue, because it comes up a lot. And somebody said it here, you need to be a specialist in a lot of different things. And if, when you look at potential opportunities, you might not necessarily need to focus on the specialty, but you deconstruct the elements of it. And does that specialty require doing research, doing analysis, doing surveys, talking to people, writing reports? And you may actually be really good at all of those elements, even though you don't possess that title of M&E specialist or health advisor. So, without exaggerating or being untruthful, you may already have the elements of this specialty, and then the elements of this specialty and this specialty, even if it's not labeled that necessarily.
Can I ask a question of the participants? How much of what we're saying is reflected in any way by what you're learning in your various situations? Is any of this ring a bell, or is it foreign speak, or is there a concern for this type of information in the learning situations you are presently participating in?
I feel like it's done a lot informally. So I've been out of grad, so I did my master's, and I'm a few years out, and I've been working. And so this all is very, speaks to my experience very strongly. Mm-hmm. But it was through a lot of the informal sort of networks in my master's program rather than sort of formal discussions about it during my
program. Yeah, I'm about to graduate from the University of Maryland, and feel like almost more so than the coursework, just where I was located and the connections I was able to make through the department and the area has led to any opportunities that I've been able to
do. Somebody had a question.
I was just going to kind of repeat what Melissa said. I also live in an area that's the University of Maryland, and my first Java meeting, I was nervous, but I never did like that. My interest is that I moved to my master's, and so I, you know, have what you guys say to everyone who's already coming to Photo Lava, the networking of the community. It really, it works.
Sorry. Do you think being in a university in the Washington area is more helpful than not, say?
Definitely. Like, I got my internship through Judith Greenberg, had worked with Counterpart International, which was based in D.C. at the time, now in Arlington. But her work and my work doesn't relate at all, other than we're both cultural anthropologists, but just a connection that she had, and then I followed up on that, and that led to an internship. And departments, I know other departments, especially Maryland, because that's my experience, the faculty are very connected in with the D.C. area. So that was incredibly helpful.
Can I ask a question also of the audience? So just a little context here. This is the fourth of four of these special roundtables that WAPA has done in coordination with NAPA today. And this is kind of an experiment. We just wanted to see what happened, because D.C. is one place where there really is a critical mass, as somebody said, and I should qualify that by saying, of non-academically based anthropologists. People here, there are many people working outside the academy as well as working inside the academy. So are most of you students or near professionals? We figured there's going to be two types of audience members, either people who want to move to D.C. and who are getting ready to graduate, or people that are already in the profession and want to come and discuss relevant professional issues with peers. So our show of hands, how many students or recent students? OK. Okay. So, and anybody that showed up to be peers that wanted to have a peer-to-peer type their years of experience of things? Okay. So
is
that. Right. Okay. Okay. So it goes that. And I would just say something I also said yesterday at one of our other sessions. Is anybody that's here not heard something they anticipated but yet wanted to discuss and trying to, you know, promote these things, making sure that, you know, we have fidelity with what we were presenting, with what you anticipated?
I just want to also add, in the field, I have a similar experience working for, working in an office, working in program management. So even when you think you're in the field and you're going to do field work, it tends to be a lot of desk work for me, at least. So I think it's not just in the DC setting, but even in the so-called field, you can have been in a very sort of administrative program management role.
And I'd like to add that the work that I've done at the World Bank, even the research, is not me doing the research. It's me helping a team design or develop a request for proposals for research to be done by local researchers, and then trying long distance, or ideally with some travel there, to assist them to make sure that the research is at the quality that the World Bank wants, and helping them in the analysis and the write-up, not the actual going out there and doing your own research.
But there is a contrast there. If you are working for an NGO, you do have to get grants, and you have to manage budgets and direct programs. But if you become an independent consultant, then they will hire you to go to Niger for 6 weeks and do some research. Or there are positions here and there where you're largely a researcher, and somebody else takes care of the administrative part.
Mm-hmm. Here's a real...
And I've had most of my experience been working as a consultant for CARE, HKI, or Save the Children, or UNICEF, and then having the position in macro where I was doing research pretty much all the time.
Lori?
Yeah, staff's position is almost unique. We usually don't get those kinds of positions. To me, what Mary said is absolutely right, what everyone's been saying, development is capacity building. So I often design studies, I design instruments, I train the researchers, but they do the actual research. I'm with them some of the time, if I'm lucky, and then I'm doing the analysis because no one ever has time to pay me to teach other people to do the analysis. But to me, another exciting part, interestingly enough, as an anthropologist, is not just doing the research, but translating those results into a viable program. And that's really exciting. That's what, to me, what practicing anthropology is all about.
Yes. It's younger anthropologists, but also just field workers in general. I mean, we don't hire I mean, we hire a lot of people.
Yeah, because the more you advance in your career, unless you're an independent consultant, the more you advance in your career, the more management you end up with.
Well, and I was just thinking about that in terms of being in Washington. And, yeah, unless you very carefully choose to be a consultant and to work on research or analysis programs, it's kind of like the slow-boiling frog that you advance in responsibility, and all of a sudden you find yourself as a manager, a management administrator, boss, and then you're assigning people, and it happens with me all the time, and I'm thinking, I'd love to do that research, and I just hired 4 people to do something, and I'm really jealous, but there's no way I can do that, and I keep getting reminded by certain people that nobody forced me to be in the position I'm in, and I actually like it. But that somewhere I made that choice, although it creeps up on you. It is like the boiling frog. It all of a sudden you wake up and you're doing spreadsheets and doing personnel evaluations, and then assigning people to do the fun stuff. But just be careful what you hope for.
And to add a point, don't you think that if you look at your career over time, perhaps you could transition back into something like being a technical advisor?
That's the plan.
That's absolutely correct.
But the only thing is, I'm concerned that to keep that specialty going.
Well, but I think one point on that is in terms of keeping up the field. I mean, now we have extensive networks, and since we're the ones doing the hiring very often, we also know all the other people doing the hiring. So when we transition back to the field work, we'll already know the people doing all the hiring. And I would assume, but I try to stay current. I mean, in analyzing other people's work and applying other people's work to programs, I'm staying current.
The contrast between being a full-time administrative staff member and being a consultant, they're extremely different. And I think Stan is an exception in that you were doing mainly consulting work, but you were a full-time employee. That's very rare. But I found that in my later years of work that when I could get consulting jobs pretty regularly, and it's not easy to just fall into consulting job. Each, you have to find, it's like looking for a new job every 2 or 3 months. Mm-hmm. It's not easy. You may get 4 or 5 of these a year and string together a decent lifestyle. But in my later years of work, I found that somewhat similarly to Stan, is that I was working for a firm that used me as a consultant rather than as someone doing spreadsheets and writing proposals. So I got to do a fair amount of actual field work later in my career, which I thought was just wonderful.
And they missed you, Michael. No, seriously.
Yeah, it can come as a shock sometimes. When I transitioned to being a direct hire Foreign Service person, I had been on contract as the research analyst, and I was paid out of program funds, which meant, among other things, there was travel money available. So I was traveling around Pakistan 2 or 3 weeks in a month. I became a direct hire person, paid out of operating expense funding, no travel money. That money is saved for the director in case he wants to go somewhere. And suddenly my horizons were that much more limited for what I wanted to be doing in terms of getting out into the countryside and finding out what was actually going on.
So you've been talking a lot about entering into the management side of the NGO world. What kind of positions are out there? What could new hires expect as far as what's available.
What field are you in?
Well, honestly, I'm kind of feeling a lot of different things out right now, but looking at international development and NGOs, in the DC area, but I guess we're also talking about doing field work. I'm just curious about like what kinds of positions are out there for recent graduates or people with just internship experience who are looking to find actual jobs.
Good question.
I can take a crack at that because we do, I mean, we wind up in that situation a lot. So do all the NGOs, I mean, just as an example. But there's the all-purpose role called program officer, which then winds up doing all kinds of odds and ends, everything from making plane reservations for more senior people to writing up analyses and working on parts of funding proposals to representing organizations at meetings and doing summaries of those. But even program officers generally are hired because they have a geographic or a topical specialty. So, you know, you may be doing all the things I just listed, but you may be hired because you know quite a bit about the Middle East or quite a bit about gender and child protection. And then there's that kind of junior officer, like well-educated but less experienced kind of role that is common among every organization. And then another role, though, is, you know, we're good, anthropologists are really good at, as I said earlier, synthesizing information. So, and NGOs need a lot of information when they are putting together funding proposals and collecting data, when they're examining their own programs, so that's monitoring and evaluation, when they're communicating to the donors and the general public, which is liaison officer, communications officer. So all of those things are just about where we put somebody coming out of school with that kind of skill set.
John, you wanted to answer?
I think the sky's the limit in terms of how you structure your career. Ironically, when my first job in Washington was with an NGO, which has now become very large, and I did this assignment in Botswana looking at preferences for different kinds of housing and infrastructure, and when I came back, they offered me a full-time job. And guess what title they gave me? Cultural anthropologist. I was floored.
Wow.
I think the president of the firm thought he was being very clever. He understood what an anthropologist was, but that was the last time I think I've been hired as a cultural anthropologist. It's sort of like, as Clifford Geertz said, an anthropologist is what an anthropologist does. But I think that, like Adam has ended up in a very senior position, and it's not something that's a surprise. You've worked in this.
It was a surprise.
Well, but it's, you know, you work towards progress in your NGO or your firm, and they all promote people, and it's, you know, just like the real world. And but this, having a specialty, I think, to start, I think that you got to. Or this program assistant role, which is not necessarily so specialized, a little more generic, but it may not be very satisfying as an anthropologist.
Could I add one more thing? Development activities tend to be categorized in terms of specific sectors, mm-hmm. So it's important to relate what you've studied in the context of the sectors in which the development is operating, agriculture, education. You may have studied something that wasn't obviously that, but there'll be applications to it. I did household economics in Greece, which is not exactly a developing country, but the household economics part was helpful. It is now, but it wasn't then. So being able to take what your background and your experience is and relating it to specific kinds of sectors and how that, you know, how you can help work in that sector is also important.
And I'm sorry, if I could just follow up on Mary's thing. And what do you guys see as either growth or strength right now in terms of specific language coming in and I, you know, specific geographic, so we know French and Spanish, for example. What do you see as that for the future, geographically? Are things shifting from Asia to Africa or Central America, that kind of thing? And then sectorally, what are some of the really, do you see in demand sorts of sectors the next 5 years, 10 years? Where is there anything moving? Is there growth? Is it developing?
Well, one can ask, I want to say one thing that before I say something frivolous about what you just said. not a making comment
well,
upon it, but a comment. And that is that when you live in D.C., you get to, anthropologists are coming into power. I mean, Adam has power, but I'm talking about people whom you will meet in D.C., like the president of the World Bank. Well, I won't meet him, but maybe Mary will.
He's an anthropologist.
He's an anthropologist. Or the president of Afghanistan, the newly elected president, whom I have met and given dinner with him, is another anthropologist. I first met him in AAA.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, he's a good anthropologist. I've read what he's written. So that's something. In terms of the frivolous was, well, it depends on how much Asheron hires other anthropologists.
Well, I think it's a very basic question that people need to hear. For example, I just thought the first part of it was back in the day. It was French, Spanish, Russian, Arabic, Portuguese were sort of the top five languages that were in demand. And then you go from there with the geography. So is that still the case, or is it shifting? You know, what is it?
I think so. Southwest, like in Pakistan and Afghanistan, those languages are useful.
And Arabic.
Yeah.
Arabic
yeah.
somewhat.
Yeah.
Oh, French,
yeah.
really?
Still.
That's like the
yeah.
most
yeah.
Right.
No, still.
Yeah. So those are still, right, okay. It's long with
Arabic
Mandarin.
Arabic is very important.
And
French is very important.
Yeah.
Spanish less so.
Okay.
One slightly different orientation is I think of sort of the development work not so much as anthropology as you're a social science researcher and you have specific skills to either collect or process or analyze data of all types. We were talking about this, somebody was talking about this earlier, that we do have those skills. We learn them in graduate school and we practice them. But you don't have to sell yourself as an anthropologist in all contexts. It's often a social scientist who knows about the interpretation, the appropriate interpretation of data of all kinds. Mm-hmm. And that you can frame yourself that way.
Yeah, I think you're probably better off framing yourself in terms of your functional skills and your experience rather than label. I know that AID's had an interesting mixed experience with anthropologists. I was hired as part of a wave back in the early 70s, and anthropologists, quay anthropologists, were around for about 5 to 7 years. And then the wave subsided. I know of at least two people who were required to white out their PhD in anthropology on their application form because they say, well, if you put that there, they'll never hire you. And right now, as far as AID is concerned, I don't know the current situation, but I don't think that anthropologists, as anthropologists, are highly valued. I think as social scientists or as functional specialists or as labels of various kinds, they're more likely to be recognized. But also, AID is not directly putting technical people in the field. They do grants and contracts to other organizations, and those are the ones that you might want to be focusing on more.
They hire loads of anthropologists. USAID, one of the largest hires in consulting terms. I thought that the role of the anthropologist was best understood in the early 70s when the Congress came through with new legislation to reach the poorest of the poor.
That's correct.
Well, how do you reach the poorest of the poor with someone who doesn't understand the culture and the language of the people you're serving? So anthropology became institutionalized in USAID over the years.
But we all changed our labels.
Well, you labels get changed because you're a manager.
I was still doing it.
No.
I was just doing it under a different label.
The administration's change and politics change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very much.
Yeah.
Each of them.
We have more questions.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could give some advice to a newcomer to this idea of networking, because it's been a month that I'm looking for a job, and I keep hearing network. But in a way, it's kind of still, for me, it's a very elusive idea, because say you're going to these meetings or talking to people, but also I feel like I can't be aggressive and say I'm looking for a job so explicitly. At the same time, you want to be get known. So it's just finding the point of, like, are you just looking for people where you know they're looking for someone? How do you make it evident that you are available without having to be too sort of forceful either? I mean, I've been in situations where I'm talking, I'd love to say I'm looking for a job and please let me know if something's happening. At the same time, it just doesn't seem...
You can
say it's that's the world of Washington. It's fine.
But the other thing, and I mentioned it earlier, though, is the cliche, but it's the informational interview where, we hesitate if we don't have a job opening and somebody says, I'm looking for a job, can we meet? I generally say no, because we don't have a job and they're looking for a job. But if somebody says, can I talk to you about this kind of work? Can I come in and meet with you and see what it's like working in your place and get some advice? Then I usually say yes. Then I've spent a half hour or an hour with somebody. Then in a month or two or three or four, when a job does open up and we get a flood of CVs, I'll remember the person I sat with for an hour.
Yeah. Okay.
But, that I'm looking for a job could close the door unless you're actually applying for a job that's been posted.
Exactly, that's the sense I get at the same time.
Well, but then you take another approach, which is, let's have coffee. And you'll get 9 rejections for everyone that agrees.
Mm-hmm.
But given that there are dozens of folks around, even at a 10% success rate, you'll wind up meeting a dozen people.
Mm-hmm.
And even better is if you find that someone in your network of friends knows somebody. It's much easier to get an appointment when you can say, well, so-and-so suggested that I contact you, rather than some unknown person coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And also, receptions and other kinds of social events related to, say, a World Bank conference or other kinds of conferences where you want to target something, they're like open game. You can talk. It's an opportunity to approach someone you don't know at all. You check out to make sure that's the kind of person that you need to talk with, and then you can just engage them in conversation, kind of sound out what's going on, and make a connection with them so that you might be able to make an appointment in the future to talk with them more.
Mm-hmm.
You want to maximize your options to make connections with people that might turn out to be a connection that would lead you to a job. And the more networks, linkages you have, the better your options are.
Washington's a schmoozing
place. Right.
And having an ability to do that without getting terribly off track, keeping focused with what you're saying, but doing it in a user-friendly, casual way is very useful in this town.
And what Mary was saying as well is you want to look to find where are the water holes, where you can go and do these kinds of things. And there are these Society for International Development, there's WAPA, there's any number of things going on at universities around about the bank and so forth. And circulation of that sort of thing is important, I think.
The Woodrow Wilson Center has lecture series on various parts of the world, various topics in development. They are great. Most of the people come, but not all, by no means all, are young people early in their careers. It is perfect for networking because there are senior people there.
I think, as Laurie said, too, for those of you who aren't in D.C., it really is a valuable, think of it as an investment to come to D.C. When I first moved here, I went to my first WAPA meeting, and Mary Clark, after the meeting, came up and said, here's my card, I'm Mary Clark. So we all introduce each other. And you're taking the first step by being here. I know we're going to wrap up, but you can show up at any given WAPA meeting, half this cast of characters is going to be there. And they're all great people, and they'll all go out with you afterwards when they're in country, which is not that often. but if you can track them down.
Well, they mostly show up for the parties.
These are right, yeah.
Yeah,
true. But it is, you got to look at it as an investment to do that.
Going out to the field and working as a local fire for some organization or a year or something. So that may have come up already, but is that, I don't know if that's as successful now as it used to be.
So I think that's what I did.
It tends to be. I mean, there's always a chance, but I know just in my personal experience, when I've been in senior positions in the field, if there's somebody smart and energetic and present that I don't have to import and that I can meet face to face in Khartoum, Sudan, or Manila, I'll hire them. So yes, it is successful.
I just want to put one sort of clarification. I went to the field and did some project and then was able to be taken on as a local hire. But I've sort of heard other things that people just go and it will happen. And that's always makes me nervous. But you still need that first step to get you in.
Mm-hmm.
Or to sort of make that first connection and to show you.
Often need a visa.
And they can make it pricey.
You know, the language study.
That's right.
I think we have to wrap up.
We have 2.5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any other comment or question,
I don't know if you raised it earlier, but coming from the international development mindset, I'm seeing so much of a focus both in USAID, World Bank, and also the NGOs down on results. And so whatever everybody does is really helpful if you are able to really show what the results are, and if you've done a framework or a logic model, or you have your indicators and how you achieve them, all those kinds of things really help in terms of being able to say what you've accomplished. Even if you work on a project internationally like we're talking about, and you identify, just keep your mind focused on what the results are.
That's a burgeoning field in international development. I mean, all the major donor institutions have use some kind of results framework and the monitoring system that grows out of that. And having knowledge of that is useful. It's a somewhat linear approach. Stan was chuckling, but it's somewhat linear and it doesn't follow the logic that anthropologists often use, but it's useful to know.
What, so what, and now what?
Yeah, what's next? You've done this, then what is required next?
That's where the anthropologists can be handy.
Yeah.
Well, the so what and now what.